Welcome, everybody. This is the fifth lecture of the Mises Academy Econ 730 course on Keynes, Krugman, and the Crisis. And today, what we're going to be talking about is the transition from the general theory to what we now think of as Keynesian economics. And we'll see that actually it's a lot more subtle than sometimes people outside of the school think, that there's a big difference between what John Maynard Keynes himself wrote in the general theory and then what so-called Keynesians did in the 50s and the 60s, and then now what modern-day Keynesians espouse. So, first of all, what happened going from John Maynard Keynes himself and the worldview he put forth in the general theory, which came out, remember, in 1936, then to what has been called either the neo-Keynesians or it's now called the old Keynesians, so it's a little bit confusing because you think that the prefix neo means new, and so you would think that the neo-Keynesians would be the opposite of the old Keynesians, but it's not. Those labels, the neo-Keynesians and the old Keynesians, refer to the same people. All right, so I can't control what the labeling is. I concede to you that that's kind of confusing, but that's just the way it is. All right, so this basic story is the general theory comes out in 1936, and even from the limited parts of it that you guys read, and especially if you were eager beavers and overachievers and read beyond the assigned readings, you'll see that even though Keynes doesn't actually have a bunch of equations in the general theory, he doesn't have all the graphs and things that we nowadays think of as Keynesian economics, even so, his argument is very mathematical. All right, so even though he wrote it out in words, he clearly was presenting a framework that was very conducive to mathematical formalism, or that it was very conducive to being distilled into mathematical equations. All right, so, and in fact, you can even, if you remember, I think it was in chapter 3? I might be getting mixed up. I think it was in chapter 3 where he starts talking about the aggregate supply price and all that stuff. And there, I mean, he literally was using phrases like saying this is a function of, or an increasing function of, and so on. And that these things intersect each other at this point and so forth. So he wasn't drawing the diagrams himself, but the general theory is just screaming out to be put into a more formal symbolic representation. And so that's what guys like John Hicks, Franco Modigliani, and Paul Samuelson did. And along these lines, if you're curious, I didn't even put it in the optional readings, but John Hicks has a famous essay, or a famous paper, I should say, called Mr. Keynes and the Classics, and that's where some of this interpretation, you can find it when it was pioneering work. And also, just so you know, that was a very famous paper, and that's why Paul Krugman called his recent lecture, which is, I think, an optional, or maybe it's even mandatory, I don't remember at this point, a mandatory or optional thing that's later on in this course. Or maybe we even already did. I don't remember what week I put it in. But anyway, Paul Krugman recently was at a thing celebrating Keynes, and he gave the most important grand finale lecture, and he titled that Mr. Keynes and the Moderns. And so Krugman's point was, let's look at our modern crisis here and all these idiots from Chicago and the Austrian school and how they can't diagnose what's happening and they're giving awful policy prescriptions. And look at, if we go back to 1936, this guy John Maynard Keynes wrote a book that tells us exactly what's going on today. And he gave surprisingly accurate policy prescriptions. So Krugman was being clever. He called his essay or his talk Mr. Keynes and the Moderns. And that was an allusion to Hicks's famous paper, Mr. Keynes and the Classics. All right, so what Hicks was trying to do was to show the difference between the system that Keynes maps out in the general theory compared to the old classical approach. All right, so again, I'm going to repeat myself, but these guys cranking out this stuff like in the late 30s and 40s to give the economics profession a bunch of tools so that they could apply Keynesian analysis to a particular problem. Because, again, John Maynard Keynes himself, it was mostly verbal analysis in the general theory. And even if you read that thing, you might be persuaded with each chapter, like, oh, yes, he's explaining the importance of the consumption function, the marginal propensity to consume. And I can totally see how in the other chapter, talking about interest rates and liquidity preference, that the classical loanable funds model is crazy and Keynes is right. And okay, all right, I see that stuff. And now Keynes has convinced me that you could have equilibrium, unemployment, even involuntary unemployment, depending on the level of output or income. Okay, I get that. But still, when you close the book, it's not obvious what to do with that. And it's not obvious how do you put all those different amazing observations from the various chapters into one coherent framework. So that's what these guys did. And the result is what you would have learned in a standard introductory macro book a long time ago. I don't know if you would learn it any longer. I never learned this stuff, like the LSLM diagram. I literally never learned that. No one ever taught that to me, because when I was at Hillsdale as an undergraduate, my professor there didn't believe in it, and he taught something else. So, I mean, it wasn't merely they didn't believe it, but he didn't even bother teaching. You would think he would teach it just so I would know what it was, or we would know what it was, but he didn't. And then when I went to grad school at NYU, there were plenty of new Keynesians there. But at that point, you know, when you're in a PhD program, they just assume you already know that stuff. So they didn't teach ISLM because that's for undergrads. So my point is just, it used to be the case that everybody who took any kind of undergraduate introductory class would have been exposed to what we're now calling here hydraulic Keynesianism or neo-Keynesian, a neo-Keynesian model or an old Keynesian model. But I'm not sure that that's the case anymore. It wasn't the case for me, but even someone going through a regular mainstream program, I'm not sure. Paul Krugman, for example, in that recent lecture was alluding to that, saying that he didn't even know if they teach this stuff anymore. All right. And part of what we're doing in tonight's lecture is I want to get to the point where you see why even a modern Keynesian might not teach that old school ISLM framework, okay? Because there is a problem with it, and we'll see what's going on in a few minutes. Okay, there's a distinction, there's sort of like a infighting within the Keynesian camp. So people like Joan Robinson and GLS Shackle, they didn't like the mathematical distillation of the general theory provided by Hicks and Samuelson and so forth. Okay, so Robinson and Shackle thought there was a lot more in the book, The General Theory, than simply saying, oh, consumption spending is a fraction of income based on what we call the marginal propensity to consume. And so therefore there's an investment multiplier, and the interest rate has to be such to make people want to hold as much money as there is a quantity of money, blah, 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 and output is determined by the intersection of these various forces, and you can get equilibrium unemployment. So that's the kind of stuff that Hicks and Samuelson did, and they capture it in the famous ISLM diagram. Robinson and Shackle and some other Keynesians, and by Keynesian I mean disciples of John Maynard Keynes, people who thought The General Theory was an amazing book and an advancement of economic thought, they said, no, you guys are focusing on the mundane stuff. That the real contribution Keynes made, the real heterodox radical contribution of John Maynard Keynes was to talk about uncertainty and to explain how it is that people grapple with the fact that the future is unknown. And so that's the kind of stuff that he dealt with a lot in Chapter 12, which was, I think, called the State of Long-Term Expectation. So I'm pretty sure I gave you guys some selections there. So that's where, if you remember, Keynes is going through saying the stock market is a casino and saying that things are dependent on animal spirits because, not because people are irrational, but because rationally we have no clue what the future is going to bring. So we basically just assume things are going to be in the future the way they are now until we get some new information to make us think otherwise. And that's partly why even just a little bit of bad news can make the stock market crash. It's not because people are overreacting, but it's rather that there's really no basis for us to make long-term forecasts. Anyway, how the heck do you value a stock? To value a stock, I mean, the story we tell is that, oh, I own the shares of stock in this company, and so what I do is I project out over the lifetime of the company all of the dividends it's going to pay me, and then I discount those payments by the expected rate of interest. And I come up with a present discounted value, and that's how much I should be willing to pay for this stock. Right? But everything I just said in that story is crazy, according to guys like Shackle. He's going to say, you can't even forecast next month. You're telling me you're going to look 20 years into the future and say, what is the dividend going to be from owning this stock? And you also know the proper discount rate to use on that 20-year cash flow event. He said, that's crazy. We have no idea what's going to happen 20 years out. So you have no way of valuing that stock right now. So people like this thought that that's where Keynes was really showing the limitations of standard orthodox economics, and that he was offering insights into how do we deal with this. So they don't like it because the ISLM framework is very deterministic. There's none of that stuff in the ISLM framework. Rather, all that's going on there is Keynes is just giving a different way of pinning down the variables in the economy. So he's just like positing different causal relationships from the ones that the classical economists did. But it's basically the same type of model. It's just a different model. Whereas when he starts talking about long-term expectations and the future is open-ended and we have no idea how to grapple with that stuff, and so that's part of the function of what money does, and that's why interest rates are what they are, and that's why investment spending is so volatile. That kind of stuff is something, it's qualitatively different from what orthodox economics had done up to that point. So let me just give you a concrete example. Why don't we just move on, because we're going to get bogged down in this. Okay, and then this last part here, I'm saying some people refer to these guys as bastard Keynesians, meaning that, they're not really the children of John Maynard Keynes, because the true full-blooded child of John Maynard Keynes wouldn't have left out all of the stuff from Chapter 12. That's the idea. Okay, so I remember Israel Kirzner in his History of Thought class at NYU. I took that, and he got to this part of the course and referred to that. And he said, call these people bastard Keynesians. And he looks up, and he was so proud. He was in a full suit and everything. And he looks up at us, and he said, no, don't misquote me. I didn't say they called them bastards. I said bastard Keynesians. He wanted to make sure that we didn't misquote Kirzner and say he was using vulgarity. Okay. Why don't we spend some time walking through the ISLM framework for two reasons. One, just the history of economic thought, and this is a course on Keynesianism, so you guys should know this. And also I want you to see how this does tie into the words that were in the general theory, right? So it's not that Hicks and Samuelson and Modigliani just made this up. This framework does capture some of the relationships that Keynes posited in the general theory in words, but it doesn't get into some of the crazier stuff. I mean, almost by definition, some of the stuff Keynes was talking about, you can't model this way. And that's part of the complaint of somebody like Shackle, was to say, it doesn't, if you're trying to say, give me a deterministic model or some graphs to tell me what Keynes was doing in the general theory, then you totally missed it. Right? That it's, if you want to say, show me a graph and put two variables on the graph and I'm going to draw a line, this still in what Keynes was talking about in Chapter 12, well, then you totally missed what he was talking about in Chapter 12. That's part of where the guys like Shackle are coming from. But on the other hand, let's go through now and see, in fairness to Hicks and Samuelson and Modigliani and the other people who created this synthesis, what we call neo-Keynesianism, let's see that, again, they didn't just make it up. There is a lot of stuff in the general theory behind these curves and so forth, this framework. So that's one reason why we're doing this, is just to fill in this gap, just so you know, as a matter of history of economic thought. The other reason I'm going to spend some time working on this is it's going to help us later on in the course, because Krugman, when he starts trying to illustrate what he thinks the problem is with the economy right now, he falls back on standard ISLM framework, or some variant of it. And Krugman thinks that the basic ISLM framework is a lot more useful now than the high-tech models coming out of the Chicago School. So even though Krugman knows that this model is obsolete in many respects, he thinks it's still pretty good, and you can quickly get a lot of answers, at least to see which way something's going to go using this framework. So that's the other reason we're going to do it, is that it will help you later on understand what Krugman's talking about if we spend some time right here going over the basics of this thing. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go forward through the PowerPoints, but then we're going to keep coming back to this slide. And so we'll illustrate the points by this coming back to this slide. And in case you're wondering, this actually, especially with the green background, this isn't the greatest slide, but I was kind of stunned doing a Google image search. I couldn't get what to me looks like a very canonical ISLM diagram. This one is what Wikipedia has, but there really wasn't anything jumping out at me from the Google image search. Okay, so the first thing, the IS curve, so that those letters stand for investment and savings. So here, there's some facts about this thing. The interest rate is the independent variable. Let me back up for a second. Let me just say some things about this ISLM diagram. Notice, let me turn on my pointer here. All right. Can you guys see that, me moving that arrow around? Okay, all right. So notice here, the variable here on the y-axis is an I. So that stands for the interest rate. Right? So that's what this axis is. It's the interest rate. Down here, obviously, the interest rate is real low. Up here, the interest rate is really high. The x-axis, and this is kind of confusing because there's a y here. So y is plotted on the x-axis. It's confusing. But y here stands for total output or total income, in terms of national output or national income. So just think of the GDP equation, that Y equals C plus I plus G plus net exports. That's what this Y here means. So it stands for total national output or total national income, which are the same thing, basically. Okay. And then the LM curve is this one right here. So notice that that's upward sloping, whereas the IS curve is this thing here, so that's downward sloping. So there's two of them. There's this IS1, and then they illustrated, they shifted out to IS2. Okay, so what we're going to So just like with a supply and demand curve framework, you've got two variables, it's price and quantity, and then the supply curve is upward sloping because there's a positive relationship between price and quantity for suppliers, and the demand curve is downward sloping because there's a negative relationship between price and quantity on the demand side, and then where they intersect is the equilibrium price and quantity. And if you change something, that can make one or both of the curves shift around, and then the intersection might be at a new point. So it's the same idea here, except instead of price, we're talking about the interest rate, and instead of quantity, we're talking about total national income. And instead of the supply curve, we're talking about the LM curve, and instead of the demand curve, we're talking about the IS curve. But again, the idea is the reason they did this, Hicks and all those guys did it this way, is because now the idea is some of the stuff Keynes talked about is summarized by the IS curve, and some of the other equilibrium relationships that Keynes talked about are summarized by the LM curve. And so in order for all those different things Keynes is talking about to all be true simultaneously, it has to be at the intersection point. That the interest rate has to be a certain value and national output has to be a certain value in order to make everything be right on the IS curve and everything be right and internally consistent on the LM curve. That's the idea. And so anyway, so now that you get the big picture, let's go through and look at each curve and see what things in the general theory was Keynes talking about in order to make Hicks and Salmonson and so on draw these curves the way they drew them. And then you'll get a rough idea of that, and then you can see how, oh, okay, so if you believed in Keynes's verbal analysis from the general theory, these curves would have these general shapes, and then it would make sense that, okay, the economy would be sort of pinned down wherever the curves crossed each other. All right, so now we're looking at slide marked A, investment saving curve. So here, the interest rate is the independent variable. So this is going to be something that's a little bit weird. Normally, when you graph stuff and you have several lines on a graph, the independent variable is the same for all the lines. So usually it's the x-axis variable is independent, but often in economics we flip it. So look at the supply and demand framework, you know, the price, the y-axis is independent usually. But still, even though it's whatever axis, usually it's the same thing. Here, it's different. Here, for one of the lines, the interest rate's the independent variable, namely the IS curve, whereas we're going to see in a minute for the LM curve, it's national income that's the independent variable. Okay, so I'm mentioning that just because that's kind of weird. If you're, you know, if you graph stuff or whatever, if you're good with math, you realize that's sort of odd. But anyway, I'm just pointing that out to you. All right, so still talking about the IS curve. So the interest rate's the independent variable. So the idea is, tell me what the interest rate is. Let's just flip back here for a second. Looking at the IS curve, this one right here. So the interest rate, the way they think about it, they're going to say the interest rate's independent. So you tell me whatever the interest rate is, and then I go out to the IS curve, boom, hit it, come down, and then I tell you what does national income have to be consistent with that interest rate. So that's what we mean when we say the interest rate is independent. Okay? I can see people talking about liquidity preference and stuff. Just hang on. All right, we're going to talk about that later. Right now we're doing the IS curve. I mean, you can talk among yourselves. I can't stop you, but my point's just I'm explaining the IS curve, and in 5 minutes we're going to talk about the LM curve. So maybe you want to just wait, and I'll tell you what all that stuff means. Okay, so what does the investment saving curve do? It traces out the combinations of interest rates in total output or income that make investment equal to saving. So remember, and this is a misconception a lot of people have. A lot of people think the Keynes believed you could have a situation where saving was higher than investment. You know, meaning like, oh, people are trying to save a lot, but there's not a lot of investment opportunities. Oh no, the reason we're in a bad recession is that investment is lower than saving. That's not actually correct. All right, Keynes goes through, I don't think I assigned this part to you guys, but Keynes goes through and he argues that no, but it's like an accounting truism, saving has to equal investment. Now, the grain of truth in what I just said a minute ago is that Keynes thinks if people are trying to save a lot and businesses don't want to invest, right, because they, you know, they don't have the animal spirit. It looks like, oh man, like the marginal efficiency of capital has collapsed. They don't want to invest. Like even if interest rates fall, that's not enough to get them to want to invest more because the consumer demand for their product is so low. What happens there is income falls until the point at which people are saving, the absolute quantity of saving equals the absolute quantity of investment. Okay, so let me just say that again because it's kind of confusing. For sure, John Maynard Keynes believed savings always equals investment in a given time period. Now the problem is, but he didn't think it for the reason that you guys might think it, right? So like a free market Austrian school type Jean-Baptiste say economist might think, oh yeah, savings and investment are equal because they think, oh, people save more, then they're going to invest in something, right? Even if you save and put your money in the bank, well, then interest rates go down and then some business comes along and borrows that money and spends it on investment. So a lot of free market people, when they say savings equals investment, they mean it, they think it's because any household that saves, that savings somehow is going to get channeled into investment, either by the household or by some business borrowing the funds. That's not at all what Keynes has in mind. When he says savings has to equal investment, he does it through accounting, you know, manipulation of accounting definitions. And so he says, okay, but now in practice, let's say there's a community and everybody decides to increase their savings, so their marginal propensity to consume goes way down. They're trying to save a lot more. They're trying to save a higher fraction of their income. Uh-oh, but what if at the same time there's a business slump, people aren't buying, right, almost by definition, if households are all trying to save more, they're not spending as much. So then what happens? So Keynes, the way he reconciles that, it's, you know what the classical economists were overlooking, but what my general theory catches, is the fact that income, national income, is not some fixed number. It itself is a variable that is determined by the system. And so, and this is where the paradox of thrift comes in. Right, so if all the households in the community, let's say they try to double their savings rate. So before, for every $1,000 of income you earned, maybe you saved $5. For every $100 of income you earned before, maybe you saved $5. Now all the households decide, oh, you know what, let's try to grow faster. Let's all save $10 now. So they double their savings rate from 5 to 10%. Under the classical model, you would think, oh, okay, now there's more savings, so now there should be more investment, and the economy should grow faster. And Keynes would say, not necessarily. In fact, you might get what's called the paradox of thrift, because everybody's saving more, so now they're not spending as much, so the income for all the businesses plummets, and then they start laying off workers, so their income goes down. So yes, we will settle down into a new equilibrium where the household savings rate is 10%, that's fine, but the absolute quantity of saving might be lower than it was originally because investment spending is going to be a lot lower now that the economy is depressed, with people not going out to restaurants. Restaurant owners aren't going to invest and so on. And the distributors, people who sell, you know, bags of frozen French fries and stuff like that, they're going to cut their investment spending because the restaurants aren't buying. So, again, how do you reconcile all that? How can it be that the households that increased their savings rate from 5 to 10% and businesses are investing a lot less, and you're telling me savings equals investment? How can that all be true at the same time? Because income can plummet. And then, and so that's what, how Keynes explains it. So that's the paradox of thrift, that people all try to save more. It's self-defeating because we end up pushing the whole economy to an equilibrium with much lower real output. So yeah, people can save a higher fraction of their income, but they can't necessarily keep their income at the same level. All right, so the IS curve captures that insight. And so this is the second point here. Note that saving increases as the interest rate drops. So that's a little bit weird. Let's just go back to this diagram. So again, here's the IS curve, the original one, IS1. So look at this. This is weird that as the interest rate drops, right, we're going down on the interest rate curve here. We're moving out on the, we're not actually moving out. We're moving out on national income. All right, so actually, what I said is true here, but I say no, as if you could observe it from the curve. Actually, let me clarify. You actually can't see it from the curve itself, but that's what's going on there. Okay, that as the interest rate goes down, that's consistent with more saving and more investment. All right, so here's what's going on. Keynes does agree that, yeah, other things equal, if the interest rate is lower, businesses want to invest more. That's true. So other things equal now, if the interest rate is dropping and investment spending goes up, that means savings has to go up. So how can that be? Right? How can you have both investment spending going up and also consumption spending goes up too? Right? Because at lower interest rates, consumers are more likely to borrow and spend more. So how the heck can it be? How can all those things be true? And remember, in like a classical framework or even an Austrian framework, that can't be true. If people are spending more on investment, well then there's less to spend on consumption. But the way it's true in the Keynesian framework is that national total income goes up. And so that's why you see this relationship. As the interest rate goes down, it has to be true to keep investment and savings equal that total income is going up. All right, so again, it's so confusing that I confused myself there. From the IS curve itself, you actually can't tell what's going on with investment and saving. You don't know which way they're moving. All you know from looking at the curve is as the interest rate drops, total income, Y, must be increasing in order to keep saving equal to investment. Okay, so, and like I say, again, the way to think about that is, the interest rate's dropping, so other things equal, that means businesses want to spend more, invest more, and also other things equal, households would want to save a smaller fraction of their income, right, because of the lower interest rate, the reward for saving isn't as much as it was before. And so the way you reconcile that is to say, oh, the only way for that to work is if total income is going up. And that's all internally consistent in Keynes's framework, that even if you're saving a lower fraction of your income, if your income's higher, the total amount of your saving can still grow. All right, so that is all that stuff. I'm not looking at this last bullet point in this slide. Business confidence, what we call animal spirits, the investment multiplier, the size of government spending, the marginal propensity to consume, et cetera, all those factors go into the construction of the, that's actually a typo, I should have just said the IS curve. All right, all those various things to make this IS curve, to know why does the curve look like this, for example, and not like this one out here, those depend on the specific things, like how much is the government spending and so on, so, and what's the marginal propensity to consume in those things. Okay, why don't we move on and then maybe this will make more sense. So now the liquidity preference money supply curve. Okay, so the LM stands for liquidity preference and money supply or money stock. Okay, so here this part, and again, I struggled with this when we were going through the general theory, this part, you're going to have to mostly take my word for it, because I was struggling with, do I assign you guys readings for this stuff or not, and I just decided not to, because in order for you to get it, I would have to have assigned a ton of reading, and I didn't want to scare you off. But let's just work through this. So here, first bullet point, with the LM curve now, total income is the independent variable. So with the IS curve, it was the interest rate. Now here, in terms of the causality in the Keynesian framework, you're thinking that the what you're varying is income, and then you want to say, what does the interest rate have to be? And what it does is it traces out the combinations of interest rates and total output or income that equate the demand and supply of money, or more specifically, the quantity demanded and the quantity supplied of money. All right, so going back to the thing here, so now we're talking about the LM curve. So again, just to, what is this thing? It's, this line is saying there's something special about these combinations of points of various amounts of y and I. So the idea is, since now we're saying that y is the independent variable here, you say, give me a national income, like this one right here, okay. And then you go up to the LM curve, and once you hit it, boom, then you go left, and you say, okay, for that particular national income, this is the interest rate right there that would make the money market clear. And by money market, I mean the market for actual money, not, you know, what we nowadays mean by the money market colloquially. All right, so again, the what's going on with these curves is various things that Keynes talks about, they're summarizing them in the two sets of curves. So the marginal propensity to consume and all that stuff is handled in the IS curve, whereas Keynes' thoughts on the quantity of money and the interest rate are primarily determined in the LM curve. And then with those things, they're pinning down relationships between the interest rate and total output or total income, and then you're saying, okay, draw those relationships out, and then wherever they intersect is where all this stuff simultaneously is satisfied, and that's got to be the overall equilibrium point of the economy. All right, so let's just talk a little bit more about this LM curve. So middle point here, at a higher income, because you might be wondering what the heck does total income have to do with the demand for money. Well, at a higher income, other things equal, people want to demand higher cash balances to satisfy what's called the transaction demand. Okay, because the higher your income, the more you're going to spend on consumption, well, and investments, but the more you're going to spend, and so other things equal, the more you want to carry around in your wallet, or the more you want to have in your bank account and a checking account. So again, that's where that aspect's coming into play. So if you follow me there, and that's not too controversial, right? That's not a specifically Keynesian thing, but where now we do get into a Keynesian twist is to say, okay, so let's say national income goes up. So the people in the community now, they're earning more income in a given time period, let's say a year. So other things equal, they want to hold higher cash balances. Because you have a higher income, you want to carry around more money on you just because you're buying more stuff. You're consuming and investing more, so you need to have more, a bigger cash balance to effect all those purchases. Okay, so now the argument is, well, if that happens and there's a fixed money stock, what would have to change to equilibrate things? So normally, like an Austrian economist would think, if you start talking about the demand and supply of money, and if you say that there's something out of kilter, like if all of a sudden the demand for cash balances goes up, the Austrian take would be to say, oh, okay, so that means the demand shifts right, So with a given fixed stock of money, that means the price of money goes up. That means the purchasing power of money goes up. That means prices in general have to fall. And that's the way you restore equilibrium. Okay, let me say that again here. So I'm switching streams here, but I'm realizing if you guys don't know what the conventional story is, you're not going to understand why the Keynesian story is different. All right, so let me just say that again and give you clearer signposts as to what I'm doing. Right now, I'm going to tell you what Murray Rothbard would say if you're talking about the demand and supply of money. And if there's a change in one of them, how do you restore equilibrium? Okay, so this is what Murray Rothbard would say. Okay, let's say you got a fixed money stock, whether it's gold or dollar bills, whatever, and you're in initial equilibrium, but now all of a sudden everybody in the community wants to hold cash balances that are twice as high, right? So right now if somebody has $500 in his wallet and in his checking account, he wants to hold $1,000. And someone who had 200 now all of a sudden wants to hold 400. Okay, it's that's a subjective preference, right? It's possible everyone in the community could all of a sudden decide they want to do that. So now what's going to give? Because suppose the quantity of money in the short run is fixed, obviously people can't just create money out of thin air. Well, unless you're Ben Bernanke, but you get what I'm saying. Let's hold that fixed for the moment. What's going to change in the economy to restore equilibrium? Because right now there's a shortage of money. People want to hold more money than there is money to go around. So Rothbard's going to say the way you restore equilibrium, if you just think of it in terms of supply and demand, we said the demand for money goes up, the supply is fixed, at least in the short run, so what has to happen? The price goes up. That's the way, if there's a shortage, the price goes up. That's the way you clear the market. But what is the price of money? Rothbard's going to say, well, that's just the purchasing power of money. The price of money is how many real goods and services do you have to get up to acquire a unit of money. So that's the inverse of what we think of as the price level, even though Austrians don't like the term price level. Let's just use it right now for convenience. All right, so if the price of money is going up, what that really means is the money prices of goods and services are dropping. And so you say, well, why would that restore equilibrium? Well, Rothbard would say, because when households want to hold money, they actually don't care about the quantity of units of money. It's not that you really care. It's not that the guy who originally had $500 and then wants to hold 1,000, it's not really that there's something special about 1,000 U.S. dollars. Really what you want to do is have a certain amount of purchasing power at your immediate disposal in your cash balances. So rather than saying, oh, I want $1,000 at today's prices, it's just as good to achieve your goal if you still have a $500, but now the price of everything in the community gets cut in half. Then you can still be holding 500 actual dollars, but you have twice as much purchasing power. So you're, in effect, your real cash balances have doubled. So that's the way an Austrian would say the community or the economy responds if there's a sudden increase in the demand to hold money. The thing that changes is the prices of goods and services fall. Okay. So that's a very conventional analysis, and so you're looking at money and saying, oh, supply and demand for money, and you're defining the price of money as the inverse of the price level. Okay. So now what does Keynes say? Keynes says something completely different. He says, if you got a fixed money stock and now the community wants to hold higher cash balances, let's say because their income goes up. And by the way, let's just be clear for a second. Some of you might be wondering, wait a minute, how can your income go up if you've got the same money stock? But if you're thinking that, you're getting mixed up. Because income is a flow variable. Income is saying how many dollars do I earn over a period of time, whereas the money stock is a stock concept. It's just some number, how many dollar bills exist at this moment in time. So even with the same quantity, the same stock of money, that could flow around more or less quickly during a year. So there's no So what I'm saying is there's nothing you can people can all earn a higher money income even if the quantity of money stayed the same. Okay, so don't let that part be tripping you up. Okay, so again, let's say there's a fixed stock of money. For whatever reason, people's income goes up. So now other things equal, they would want to hold higher cash balances because now with a higher income, they're buying more stuff. And so whatever they decided on before is the optimal amount of cash to hold, now they're going to bump that number up. But they can't. That's physically impossible. The community can't all hold more money than they did before if there's a fixed stock of it. So what does Keynes say has to change in order to restore equilibrium? He doesn't say, oh, there's going to be price deflation, the way Murray Rothbard would say. No, what Keynes says is the interest rate goes up. You might sit, and so this is very confusing because for non-Keynesians, you say, what the heck, what does the interest rate have to do with it? The interest rate is a very particular thing. Why wouldn't the demand for money result in the price of money in general changing? Why wouldn't it result in all these prices changing? So it's an odd thing that Rothbard would have said prices in general go down, and yet Keynes is saying, no, one particular price, the price of borrowing money, goes up, and that's the way it restores equilibrium in the short term. All right, so where's Keynes coming from? Well, this is the issue of liquidity preference. And again, I don't think I assigned anything, and it's just because it's like once you start going down that path, it can devour you. Okay, so that's why I don't even think I assigned you guys anything from this. But what he's talking about is he's saying, okay, why is it that we hold cash in the first place? And you might say, because we want to buy something you're going to buy something in the future, so you have the cash because you're going to buy it. And Keynes would say, well, wait a minute. If you're going to buy something like next month, you don't need to hold cash for it. You should take that cash and go buy a one-month bond and earn some interest on it, right? Because the cash earns a 0% nominal rate of return, whereas the bond, the one-month bond, gives you some positive rate. So you would always do better off if you knew exactly when your purchases were going to be in the future. It would be silly for you to hold any cash at all. You should just go buy bonds of the appropriate maturity or duration so that they come due and you get paid off and you get your principal and interest back right before you make that purchase. And then you would do strictly better than if you just sat on the cash. So Keynes is saying in a world of certainty, nobody would hold any money. They would just deplete their cash balances by buying shorter or longer term investments. All right, and incidentally, just so you know, that's not a weirdo Keynesian argument. That's Mises says that about the evenly rotating economy. He says that's one of the problems with the evenly rotating economy as a conceptual tool is that strictly speaking, if there's pure certainty, nobody would hold money because for the exact reason that Keynes is talking about. All right, So now, what conclusion does Keynes draw from that? So what Keynes does with that observation or that insight is he says, okay, so in the real world, the reason you hold cash is uncertainty, is that you're not sure when you're going to want to actually turn your abstract purchasing power into a consumption or an investment expenditure. Because if you were sure, you wouldn't hold cash. Like I said, you would invested in a shorter or longer term bond. So the reason you keep some of your wealth in the form of cash balances is to give yourself flexibility so that, oh my gosh, if something comes up tomorrow that I wasn't thinking of where I need to spend money or I need to buy something, let's say, at that point, if I have all of my wealth in the form of bonds or other real estate, whatever, stocks, and I need to be able to purchase something, well, I'm going to have to sell those things off to get money. And I might, depending on if things have changed, I can't be sure of how much I'll get for it. And so this, so that you're saying the reason you hold money is because money, by definition, is the most liquid of assets. So let's, what does liquidity mean? Liquidity means, in common parlance, liquidity says how easily can I convert an asset into its, let's say, fair market price. So a gold coin is, especially if it's not some real obscure exotic thing, is pretty liquid. Like if it's just like a, you know, gold eagle or something, you can just go to a coin store, go to eBay, and you can get the price you're likely to get for it without searching too hard. Whereas to sell a five-bedroom house, that's a very illiquid asset. That you might say, oh, what's the market value of that property? You might say, oh, it's whatever, $400,000. But if you had to sell it tomorrow, like you absolutely needed the money tomorrow, you're not going to get $400,000 for it. But when you say that the market price of a home is $400,000, what you mean is if you've got an agent, if you put it on the market, you listed it, you had open houses, and you spent perhaps months marketing it, you'd probably get somebody willing to pay you $400,000. Okay, whereas you're not going to have to market a gold coin for 4 months in order to get the highest price you're likely to get for it. Okay, so that's what liquidity means in conventional parlance. So Keynes is saying one way to think about money is it is the most liquid of assets. If you have a $100 bill and you say, well, how much can I get for it? Well, you can get $100 for it instantly. You get what I'm saying? It almost seems you either think that that's a brilliant insight or it's the stupidest thing ever. Take your pick. But the point is that's where Keynes is coming from, that money is the one good that you don't have to worry, am I going to be able to turn it into a certain amount of money if I need it? No, it already is the money. Okay, so just for example, let's say you've got $1,000 and you're pretty sure you're going to spend it on your rent 2 months from now. Let's say you pay $1,000 in rent. So you're pretty sure, yep, this portion of my wealth, I'm going to allocate it to giving to my landlord 2 months from now. It's $1,000. So instead of letting it just sit there, man, the smart thing to do is I should take it and lend it, you know, buy a 2 month bond that yields me whatever, 0.3% interest in absolute terms. I don't mean like an annualized rate. I mean, I'm actually going to earn 0.3% over the course of the 2 months. So why don't I do that? Well, the problem is, let's say you go ahead and do that and you take your $1,000 in cash, you turn it into this 2 month bond. And then a week goes by, and then all of a sudden you get in a car accident or something, and you have medical bills that you have to pay. And you got to take your – so you say, oh, gee, had I realized in the beginning that this was going to happen, I wouldn't have bought that bond because I need the cash to pay this, and then I'm going to – I'll do something else in the interval of 2 months in order to get money to pay my landlord 2 months from now. But right now that $1,000, I need to pay off the medical bills. Well, now that it's in the form of the bond, you say, oh, well, I'll just sell the bond and turn it back into cash. But suppose interest rates have gone up in the meantime. Well, now the market value of your bond could be less than what you paid for. It could be less than $1,000. All right, so if you're willing to stick it out and wait for maturity, you're going to get your money back plus the principal. But the point is if you want to bail out early, if you change your mind and once you buy the bond, you realize, oh, no, I want to sell it earlier than the maturity date and raise as much cash as I can for it, you might get back less than you put into it if interest rates have risen. Because when interest rates go up, bond prices go down. Okay, so that's the idea. So your $1,000, if you had just kept your $1,000 in a very liquid form, namely in actual cash, you don't have that problem. Your $1,000 is going to always be $1,000. Whereas you put your $1,000 into $1,000 worth of bonds, that price can fluctuate over time. So notice, we're not even talking about what if somebody defaults on the bond. We're not even talking about that. What we're saying is, even if you're sure you're going to get paid, you might have to bail out early. You might have to sell the bond to a third party before it's matured. And then what that person's going to give you for it depends on the interest rate. And since you don't know exactly what interest rates are going to do over time, you can't forecast the spot market price of your bond. Okay, so that's, so now I think you can at least get the idea of where Keynes is coming from. He's saying, so now you see, because of liquidity preference, that's why people are willing to hold cash and earn a 0% interest rather than turning it into bonds, because there's a chance if interest rates change, you could, you know, you could be in a pickle if you have to sell the bonds off and turn them into cash to buy something, where that won't happen if you hold just cash. Now, the downside, of course, is there's an opportunity cost. The higher the interest rate, the more potential interest income you're giving up by keeping some of your wealth in the form of cash. So there's that trade-off. And so that's why, coming back now finally to this slide, that was kind of a long digression I went on there, coming back to this, the point is, if the community, remember, they all want to hold more money. They want to all increase their cash balances, but there's not more cash to go around. It's a fixed stock of money. What has to give to restore equilibrium? Keynes says, oh, interest rates go up, especially short-term interest rates. Because now if short-term interest rates go up, other things aren't equal, and people say, oh, yeah, I did want to hold more cash, but now the opportunity cost of holding cash is higher because I could take that cash and buy short-term bonds with it. And so now, even though before I wanted to hold more cash, now because short-term interest rates went up, that offsets my changed preference, and now I'm back to where I was before. Now, with the higher interest rate, is like a penalty on holding cash because I'm giving up the ability to earn the short-term interest rate. I'm back to being happy holding the original amount of cash. And so that makes everybody happy again, and the community collectively wants to hold the same amount of cash as there is in the economy. Okay, so that's why Keynes thinks interest rates move to equilibrate the supply and demand for money. So this last point here on the slide is just notice how that is completely foreign to what Keynes would call the classical framework, but also to what most Austrians adhere to. So in the classical, orthodox, and even Austrian view, the interest rate has to do with the loanable funds market. The interest rate equates the supply and demand for loanable funds or for credit, if that's the way you want to think about it. The interest rate is not particularly relevant for the supply and demand for money itself. There, the Austrians would just say, well, no, that's the price of money. And here's one good way of putting it. The price of, in the Austrian view, the price of money is not the interest rate. They think that's just a categorical mistake to say that the interest rate is the price of money. And so if you just think about a regular supply and demand framework, if Keynes is saying the way the economy fixes an excess demand for money or a shortage of money is to have the interest rate go up, that makes it sound like he's saying the interest rate is the price of money. And the Austrians are going to say, no, that's just wrong. The interest rate is not the price of money. The purchasing power of money is the price of money. The interest rate, if you want to call it the price of something, is the price of borrowing money, or it's the price of getting credit, perhaps, but it's not the price of money. All right, so that's the fundamental distinction in terms of how Keynes looked at money and interest rates versus the classical loanable funds approach that modern Austrians have adopted. Okay, so let's flip back here very quickly to this LM thing. Okay, so now we're in a position, now that I gave you that digression, we can understand why is it that the LM curve is upward sloping. Because, remember, the why is the independent variable in this sort of analysis. So you say, okay, why is it that as income goes up, why does the interest rate have to go up to maintain equilibrium? And the idea is, well, because at a higher level of income, because of that transactions demand, people want to hold higher cash balances. But if we're holding the money stock fixed, that, you know, how are you going to do that? Well, the interest rate has to go up in order to maintain equilibrium in the supply and demand for money. So that's why the LM curve is upward sloping, because the two variables in this diagram, remember, are Y and the interest rate. And I just explained to you why in the Keynesian view, if income goes up, the demand to hold money goes up. If the stock of money is fixed, something else has to change to push down the demand for money. And so the other thing that changes is interest rates go up. Okay, so now we got that. And now let's do one more slide on this and we'll move on. Okay, so now you get the basic idea of how this ISLM framework works. So now what about restoring full employment? So the idea here is we've talked about the determinants of the IS curve and the determinants of the LM curve, and you can see where they intersect, what's special about that. You say, oh, that's the combination of the interest rate and the level of total output that satisfies all of those different criteria. So that's it. That's the only equilibrium framework. That's where the economy is going to be. But famously, the Keynesian system, there's no reason that you need to have full employment at that level of output. If that level of output happens to be below the level at which all of the workers are employed, tough luck. There's nothing in the system that makes it quickly move away from that point. That's a stable outcome. So let's go back here. So at this initial IS curve, which, you know, we look at the animal spirits, we look at the marginal propensity to consume, we look at how much government spending is, blah, 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 and that's the IS curve we draw, IS1, because it's the initial one. Then we look at the household demand to hold money, all that stuff, and then we draw the LM curve, and where they intersect, up, they intersect right there. So this I1 is the equilibrium interest rate, and this Y1 is the equilibrium level of total output, and there's nothing, what if full employment level of output is right here, is to the right of Y1. There's nothing saying it won't be. This is perfectly consistent with all Keynes's remarks. So the idea is this economy now is going to be stuck with a high level of unemployment. There's going to be a lot of idle resources lying around. So what do we do? Because there's nothing in the market economy that will change to make the labor market clear. Everything is perfectly stable right now. So what you got to do is you got to move those curves around. The government needs to change policies, or the Federal Reserve needs to change policies in order to move those curves around so that the new intersection point is to the right of the current one. So what are some of the things they could do? Well, if the government spent more, or if the households and the private sector decided to save less, that would shift the IS curve to the right. All right, so that's what is depicted in this particular diagram that I stole from Wikipedia. If we could somehow get that IS curve to move to the right while the LM curve stayed the same, that would be a good thing. You'd see interest rates would go up, okay, but more important, why you go from Y1 out to Y2. So in order, so you can say, well, but physically, how is that happening? How is it possible the economy is producing more? And the Keynesian said, because they're unemployed, people are going back to work. There's a bunch of factories that were running at 70%. Now they're running at 95%. Duh. That's how we're producing more. They're going to say, we were producing below the PPF, the production possibilities frontier, before at Y1. And now, because we got that IS curve to shift to the right, we're now operating closer to full employment. So that they're saying there's no violation of the laws of physics or anything. They're saying what the problem is you classical economists, or you Austrians, or you Chicago school guys, you thought that the economy always would quickly move towards full output with full employment, and you're just wrong. So you think that there's always these trade-offs, and that if the government spends more, well, that means the private sector must be spending less, and you guys are just wrong, because total output and total income can increase. So you can have investment and consumption going up at the same time. There's not this trade-off if you start at in a recession position. Okay, so how did they get that IS curve to move? Well, they, if the government, well, if households save a lower fraction of their income, that's one way to do it. And another way, let me just deal with the government expenditure. If the government just spends more, that's another way to do it. And there, the way to see it is national income, Y here, is a function of, it's just total spending. So consumption, private investment, government spending, and then the spending by foreigners on net exports. So they're going to say, if the government just decides to, now it's important, how does the government spend more? If it does, if it taxes and spends more so the deficit stays the same, that's not going to do anything. Because then it's taxing, you know, money out of the private sector, so the people in the private sector can spend less and the government's spending more, so that doesn't really raise total spending. But if they run a deficit, if the government spends more without taking it from the private sector, then they're going to say you can have this, the Eyes curve can move to the right. That you go through the factors that made you draw this original Eyes curve, and one of the things was how much is the government spending and how big is the government budget deficit, and then if you increase that, you can end up out here and you redraw. That's the idea. Okay, and then the last thing here is, suppose the Fed increases the quantity of money. How can that help? Well, what it's going to do is shift the LM curve down, and let me explain that. So you can see graphically, if the LM, so let's go back to this original point here. Remember this point here where we said that was at less than full employment? Suppose for some reason, oh, we've got those crazy Republicans in Congress, and they're listening to Ron Paul and Judge Napolitano, so they're refusing to run a budget deficit. So what can we do? Because this point here is less than full employment. How do we get the new intersection point to move to the right? Oh, well, if we get this LM curve, if we could slide that down, then the new intersection point would move to the right. It would also push down interest rates. Right? So that's, just notice that, that if the way you fix things is you move the IS curve to the right, you get higher output at higher interest rates. If you fix things by pushing the LM curve down, then you get higher output with lower interest rates. Right, just the way these curves work. Okay, so really quickly, because we definitely have to end on time today because I had the double header going on. What, in the Keynesian framework, why would the central bank printing more money, why would that push down the LM curve? Well, because think about it. Other things equal, the more money there is, the less the penalty has to be on holding money in order to get you to maintain a certain size of cash balances. Okay, so let me put you this, let's go the other way. Remember before when we said, I figured out the better way to say it. The Fed comes in and it increases the quantity of money. So that means that right now, the moment after they do that, households have more cash balances than they want. Right? So what do you, how does that get fixed is, well, you know, interest rates would have to go down. And so the idea at the same level of real income. So what you're doing, if the Fed comes in and changes the quantity of money, that pushes the whole LM curve down. Because remember, the LM curve, to draw the curve, you're assuming a fixed stock of money. Because you're tracing, notice here, this LM curve, these variables are not the quantity of money. The variables that are changing are I and Y. So the LM, a given LM curve assumes a fixed stock of money. So what I'm saying is if you all of a sudden increase the stock of money, you have to draw a new LM curve. And my point is you're going to draw it lower than the original one. Because now, since there's a bigger stock of money for the same amount of real income, in order to get people to be willing to hold that much money, you need a lower interest rate. Because you don't want the penalty on money holding to be that high because you want them to hold a lot of money. Because there's more in existence. Okay, so that's why if you create more money, increase the stock of money, the LM curve itself shifts down. And so then you can see with the geometry here that, oh, okay, yeah, or I should say the graphs, if the LM curve shifts downward, then the new intersection point is going to be to the right. All right, so that's the basic framework. Now, as far as you don't have to understand, how can I put it? You're only going to be responsible for this stuff that I put on these diagrams here in terms of when I test you on this stuff later on if you're taking the course for credit. So I gave you those words of me speaking there to try to make it make more sense to you, but I'm not going to quiz you on something real subtle that I said in words but that I didn't codify and type out here. All right, so if you vaguely followed me there but you didn't quite get every last little nuance, don't worry about it. I just wanted you to try to get the idea of how Hicks and Samuelson, when they drew up that ISLM framework, they weren't just pulling it out of the air. There is that stuff in the general theory. Okay, so now what about what happened to the neo-Keynesian, old Keynesian, or what's sometimes called hydraulic Keynesian view, where you've just got these sort of mechanical relationships? Well, they came under withering scrutiny from people who tended to be free market, and it's possible that historically that was the motivation. I never really thought of that until just now, but it could be that because these people ideologically didn't like the policy conclusions that popped out of this old school neo-Keynesian model, such as when you have a recession, the government should run a big budget deficit, or the central bank should print a bunch of money. Maybe these guys were focusing their attention on what's wrong theoretically with that framework. I don't know. We'll never know that. But whatever the reasoning is for their motivations, it's undeniable that two of the big guns who devastated old school Keynesianism were Milton Friedman and Robert Lucas, both very free market Chicago school economists. Okay, so now here I'm not necessarily giving you the exact historical progression of this person said this and then this person said that and on and on. I'm just giving you some of the big picture items, and they're all related to each other, but again, this isn't necessarily following the chronology of how this stuff played out in the journal articles and the debates that Friedman and Lucas would have had with the Keynesian representatives of the time. So one component in all this to see how Friedman was challenging the old school Keynesian framework is this thing called the permanent income hypothesis. So here, what he's taking on is the idea that so part of what's going on in the Keynesian framework, where to draw that IS curve in the first place, remember, is all the stuff about the marginal propensity to consume, and that's what gives you the investment multiplier. Where if private business or the government decides to spend $1,000 more in investment, that might lead to $5,000 more of total output. So where that kind of stuff comes from is things like the marginal propensity to consume. And there, remember, what Keynes is saying is that, okay, if you increase people's income, they consume more, but not proportionally. So if with a marginal propensity to consume of 0.8, if somebody's earning $100 more in income, he'll spend 80 more on consumption and he'll save 20 more. And that's the way you figure out what the multipliers are. Because you figure, oh, if we could just boost income, then, if we boost spending, well, then that boosts income, but then people consume more, so that boosts more, da 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 da. And that's how you get this stream of, you know, rippling effects. And an initial injection of more spending leads to more and more spending as it trickles out, because each round raises other people's income and then they spend the marginal propensity to consume times that. Okay, so part of what's going on here is Friedman is saying, no, that's totally wrong. And also, this is, you probably have heard this, the using that marginal propensity consume framework, if your income is zero, you still consume, right? That if you draw the marginal propensity consume line, it'll have a slope, let's say, of 0.8, but the intercept is not at zero. So the idea is even if you earn zero income, the Keynesians say, oh, you still got to consume because you still got to eat. And then as you earn more and more income, your consumption rises, just not one for one. All right, so the idea is there that poor people save a lower fraction of their income, and rich people save a higher fraction of their income. Because, yeah, it's true, on the margin, you keep adding more income, they keep saving the same fraction, but the point is at very low incomes, you still have that absolute amount of consumption going on. All right, so that's what gives you the result that poor people consume a higher fraction of their income than rich people, and that's why the Keynesians will say social safety programs are good to get out of a recession, because you're taking money, you know, government taxes take money from rich people who are probably going to save a lot of it anyway, and it gives it in food stamps and unemployment benefits to poor people who are going to go spend most of it, consume most of it. And so that's a good thing. That's going to prop up aggregate demand. All right, so Friedman is taking that view head on, and he's saying, no, you guys are wrong. It's because you're looking at the data wrong. So let's give you the theory first, and then we'll explain why they're looking at the data wrong. So Friedman is saying, consider a rational household. They're not going to make their spending decisions solely on the basis of what this year's income is. Rather, they're going to say, what's my income this year, and what do I think it's going to be next year, and the year after, going out into the future? And then, based on that, you make decisions about how much to consume or to save. And as this middle bullet point says, if you make some assumptions about that are fairly reasonable, things like people prefer to not have wild swings in their standard of living, stuff like that, then the result that pops out is people, when they have a year where they're earning above average income, they tend to save a higher fraction. And then when they're in a year where their income is low relative to their lifetime path, they consume a higher fraction. And so what you're doing is over your life cycle, you're smoothing out your consumption. So the idea is if you have a phenomenal year and you're earning twice as much as you think you're ever going to earn again, you're not going to go on a bunch of cruises and just blow all that money. No, you're going to save most of that bonus so that you can raise your standard of living over your whole life cycle. And by the same token, if you have a year where you get laid off and you're in between jobs, you're probably not going to go from driving around in Ferraris and going out to get steak every night to eating ramen noodles and living in a shack. No, you'll draw down your savings. That's part of why you have savings, is so that when you hit a dry spell with your income, you draw down your savings so that your consumption doesn't have to fall off a cliff. Okay, so that was the theoretical framework that Friedman developed. And so the point is, in case you're wondering, well, what's the difference between what he's saying and what the Keynesians are saying? The Keynesians are saying, oh, somebody who's making $100,000 a year, that's a lot of money, and so they're going to save a lot of it. And Friedman is saying, no, what if it's a person who's a really, a hedge fund manager, and he normally expects to make $1 million a year? That's an average year for him to make $1 million. If he has a really awful year and only makes $100,000, that person might not save anything. In fact, he might draw down his savings. He might consume $400,000 that year. And so his savings rate would be negative. So the point is, you can't just say what fraction do people save based on what is their income that year. Rather, you have to say, you have to look at a particular household and look at it longitudinally. Right, so that the Keynesians, their mistake is they were taking a cross-section of the data, and they were saying at any given time, you take a snapshot, if you look at a correlation, the people who make a higher income tend to have a higher savings rate. And so they thought that, aha, see, Keynes is right. it does seem like people, you know, that there's this marginal propensity to consume, and that's why the more income you make, the you're consuming more, but it doesn't rise one for one, and that's why the proportion of your savings increases. And Friedman is saying, no, you guys are just being silly. Yeah, sure, any given year you take a snapshot, the people that are earning high incomes, statistically, that's likely to be their above average earning years. You get what I'm saying? So in any given year, the people in the top 10% of income earners, other things, you know, statistically, it's more likely that those people are having above average years. And by the same token, the people that are in the lower branches, those people are more likely to be having down years. And so, yeah, you would tend to see in the data that high income earners save a higher fraction of their income, but it's not because any given household, if you make a certain amount of money, you save a certain fraction. That's the idea. Okay, we're running low on time here, so I got to speed it up. Let me just look ahead and see how many slides I had here. Okay, yeah, so I got to go a lot faster. Hold on here. Okay, rational expectations. So now we're talking about Robert Lucas. So he comes along, again, also a pretty free market, Chicago school type guy. And what he did, his contribution, what was called the Lucas critique, is he said that the 1950s and 60s style macroeconometric Keynesian models, they just had these big aggregate relations to the, you know, big variables like total output and total investment, things like that, and they found relationships among them and then assumed that the Fed or the government could come in and tinker with one of those numbers, one of those variables, and the relationships would stay the same among the relationship between those things and the other variables, and you could just manipulate the economy. And what Lucas said is, no, you can't. It doesn't make sense. You can't have a model where the people in the model don't know what's going on, where they don't even understand the way the model works. He just said that's inconsistent. People would learn that. So you can't, in other words, you can't keep fooling people with your policies. Eventually they're going to catch on. And so the way to, what Lucas said is, going forward, if we want to make a good model, it's got to be, it has to obey what's called rational expectations. So it doesn't mean that the people in the model are omniscient. Right? That this is a common misconception. I hear a lot of times even Austrians will say, oh, yeah, these mainstream economists, they think everyone's got rational expectations and they know the future, but we Austrians know that the future is uncertain. Right? That's not really – don't say that, because then if somebody who knows economics hears you say that, they're going to think you don't know what you're talking about. It's fine in a rational expectations model for there to be uncertainty, but it's more like what Austrians would call risk. So you can have what are called random variables. You can have things that are probabilistic, like the if people in the model are going to buy an asset, it's okay. Robert Lucas is fine if you say they don't know what the asset's going to be, if it's going to be worth a certain amount, like $100 next year, or if it's going to be worth $50 next year. It's fine to say people don't know that going into it. But what he does want to have happen is people know, oh, there's a 20% chance this stock is going to be worth $100 next year, and there's an 80% chance it's going to be worth $15 or whatever. You know, you can make a more sophisticated probability distribution. But the point is the agents know the probabilities of various things. Okay? So what I say is I like to use a blackjack analogy. If you guys know the game, this will help. If you don't know it, it won't help. What Lucas is saying is he wants to obey rational expectations. The player has to be smart in the sense of and rational in the sense that he makes the proper move based on the information he has at his disposal. So if you're playing blackjack and you have an 11 and the dealer's showing a 6, and it's a freshly shuffled deck, it's a brand new deck, it's the first hand of the game, and you've got an 11 and the dealer has a 6, the correct move, the rational move for you to do is to double down. However, it's possible you're going to lose, that maybe the top card is a 3, the dealer flips a five and then pulls an eight, and so you end up losing. So had you known with certainty the value of the dealer's down card and the next two cards in the deck, you would have surrendered your hand. Or maybe you would have hit, I forget what numbers I said, maybe you'd want to hit, I forget what I said. But you get the point. You wouldn't want to double down. That would be the wrong thing to do if you knew the composition of the hidden cards. But the point is, when you got to make that decision, you don't know. So you got to just play this, the odds. So it's the correct move to double down, even though you might regret having done so after the fact. So that's what rational expectations is like. It's saying you're rational in the sense that you don't make a mistake given the information you had at the time, and on top of that, your information is correct. So there, if you're playing blackjack, you have to know what are the probabilities of getting various cards. Okay, you can't think that there's three aces in the deck. You have to know there are four aces in the deck, that kind of thing. Okay, Phillips curve versus stagflation. So the Phillips curve is the traditional trade-off between unemployment and inflation, and it's derived directly from Neo-Keynesian thinking. And the idea is, oh, if there's high unemployment, the central bank can print a lot of money, and that will boost employment. And you can even see that going back to the ISLM curve, right? That if we're below full employment, what do? Oh, they can print a bunch of money that pushes down the LM curve. Short-term interest rates drop, we get higher output, but we can get higher prices, and the higher prices aren't in the ISLM framework itself. And so Friedman and Lucas, their critiques undermine the theoretical foundation of that. That, you know, they're saying, well, if workers are rational, why should they, you know, they shouldn't be fooled by money illusion. The fact that they're getting higher paychecks, but prices are rising even faster, that shouldn't fool the worker. Things like that. And so there shouldn't be this trade-off between unemployment and inflation. And so they're making theoretical critiques, and the Keynesians are going, yeah. But then the thing that was the actual death blow was the 1970s. Because in the 1970s, you had stagflation, where you had high unemployment and high price inflation at the same time, and that was supposed to be impossible. In the old school neo-Keynesian framework, the trade-off was supposed to be between unemployment and price inflation. You're supposed to be able to get one or the other. If you had high price inflation and you wanted to get that under control, the central bank could jack up interest rates, you know, contract the quantity of money, the government could start running budget surpluses, and yeah, you could solve one or the other. So you could definitely clamp price inflation down, but then you'd cause unemployment and the economy would crash. So the idea was you could deal with one or the other, and it was just a trade-off in terms of the preferences of the policymaker. What do we want to do? Do we care more about inflation, or do we care more about unemployment? But in the 1970s, they had the worst of both worlds. It was like no matter what they did, both things were bad, and that was a problem. And so people said, oh, yeah, Milton Friedman and Robert Lucas have been right all along. These Keynesian solutions are wrong. And now that the workers and labor unions have caught on to what's going on, now they're increasing their wage demands. And so even if the government does print more money, you still get rising prices, but now unemployment doesn't go down because the workers have increased their wage demands, and so you're still having above market clearing wage rates. So that's the idea. So what actually happens is if you plot the apparent Phillips curve, this trade-off statistically between unemployment and inflation, it kept shifting to the right. And so the trade-off kept getting worse and worse, that to get a certain given amount of unemployment, you had to be willing to tolerate higher and higher price inflation. And so the idea was, they were saying, no, you guys, you're just making it worse. The more money you print and the more you keep turning to inflation to try to solve the problem of unemployment, you just keep making the short-term, you're making the trade-off worse over time. And ultimately, that's not a solution. That yes, it's true. If you come in all of a sudden and people aren't sure what you're going to do, and you print $1 billion and spend them, you might provide temporarily some more employment. But then once people adjust to that, now the unemployment's going to go back up, and then next time you got to spend $2 billion that people weren't expecting, and so on. So it's like the it's the catching, you know, having the tiger by the tail that Hayek talked about, these guys were doing it in more formalized mathematical models. Okay, last thing here, New Keynesianism. So these are some of the proponents of New Keynesianism. You got Greg Mankiw, Paul Krugman, Ben Bernanke, and Larry Summers. So actually, depending on how broadly we define the category, I think most practicing economists today could be considered New Keynesians, because what the New Keynesians do is they adopt the rational expectations approach that Lucas advocated. Okay, so right now, if you're going to get an article published in a journal and your article violates rational expectations, that's going to be a huge strike against it. It might even just be make it off the table. Like, no, we're not going to publish a model where the agents don't obey rational expectations. And that used to be the case, but now with the financial crisis, maybe people aren't so sure anymore. But that used to be true, that if your model didn't have rational expectations, then you couldn't get it published in a reputable journal. Okay, now the problem is, if you have a Chicago school type model where all the agents are really smart, they obey rational expectations, and where all the prices and all the various markets are perfectly flexible, well, then you can't do anything fun. The market always works. There could be a shock to oil prices. There could be a technology shock. The quantity of money could fall in half overnight. And if all prices instantly adjust, nothing happens. You still get the same amount of real output, or you get to the new equilibrium, but the labor market always clears. There's never any gluts. It's just everything's fine. So you can't do anything fun. So then what do the new Keynesian models do? Well, they have to introduce various market failures and rigidities. So things like sticky wages. And then they say, if wages can't instantly adjust downward, well, then it would matter. If all of a sudden the quantity of money falls in half, well, that means that households are trying to hold more cash than exists. So that means to restore equilibrium, the price level comes down. But if the price level comes down and wages can't move down, then now all of a sudden workers, their real wages have gone way up, and that's higher than their marginal product. So now employers don't want to hire so many workers. And now you have a glut in the labor market. And so you have massive involuntary unemployment. Okay, so that's why, because of rigid or sticky wages, then there's a role for the Fed to come in. And if the demand to hold money goes up, well, then the Fed had better create a bunch of new money, because otherwise we're going to get massive unemployment. And so you can see the fact that some prices and wages can't instantly adjust in the face of new circumstances, that's one of the things that a new Keynesian model might have in order to. So the idea is you want to be able to have rational agents and yet still get market outcomes that are bad, and to have a role for the policymakers to do something. And it's fine. I know that sounds like a conspiracy theory, like I'm saying, the economists are justifying having their jobs. And in a sense, that is true, but in another sense, they're saying, well, no, the model has to yield realistic outputs. And if we have a Chicago school type model where all the wages are perfectly flexible, there's never any problem in the labor market at all. We always have full employment. We can't have a boom-bust cycle. But we know in the real world there are boom-bust cycles. So clearly that model's not doing anything for us. We got to tweak the model to make it more realistic to get a recession in it, and then we can say, what do we do to fix the recession? So that's where the new Keynesians are coming from. Okay, well, unfortunately, I went over time here, and I can't go over more because I have at the top of the hour, I'm starting another class because we're doing the back-to-back classes. So I'm sorry I don't have time to do your Q&A. I will, of course, catch up to them in the forum, but I can't do it now because, like I said, I got to start the next class. However, I don't regret that we spent this much time. There was a lot of material here, and this is stuff that you wouldn't get except to hear me say it, because this isn't in the readings I assigned. So anyway, thanks for tuning in, and I will on Thursday sent out an email blast telling you about the quiz and if we're going to have office hours. I need to check the schedule because, again, I'm here down in Auburn at this conference. I'm not sure on Saturday what the flexibility is going to be. Okay. So thanks, everybody. And like I say, I will, if you have questions, just post them in the forum and I'll answer them there to make sure you follow this stuff.